Hello and hi there. Welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week, I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. And that website has so many articles today, I really have more content than time. I love it when that happens. So let's get started. First, I have the must list. Fantastic Four First Steps, Justin Bieber's Swag, and Light and Magic top this week's must list. Melissa O'Connor's new novel and Post Animals' latest single round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. As promised last week, I'm writing this editor's letter while sipping an iced cold brew, and I normally don't drink coffee at all. Our Entertainment Weekly team is in the thick of San Diego Comic-Con, bringing you all the breaking news and celebrity interviews from the convention and our photo and video studio atop the Hard Rock Hotel. And that's after launching our 2025 Comic-Con preview issue earlier this week. Is it Monday yet? That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. First item on our list, Fantastic Four First Steps. Big superhero blockbusters love to scream loud and proud at audiences, bombarding them with noise and destruction. The new Fantastic Four takes a different approach, prioritizing a quieter family dramedy over spectacle. Though don't get me wrong, the production design is stunning. Led by a fantastic Pedro Pascal, Vanessa Kirby, Joseph Quinn, and Ivan Mas-Bachrach, director Matt Shakman's film shines as a family dramedy that chooses to relatively calmly converse with its audience through the entire Planet in Peril finale. Bonus points for a post-credits scene that actually impacts the future of the MCU. Light and Magic is our second item. Picking up where season one left off, this fascinating and candid Disney Plus docuseries follows George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic team through the turn of the century, embracing the criticisms of the Star Wars prequel trilogy while celebrating the visual effects studio's pioneering role in the digital film revolution. Justin Bieber's Swag. Don't be fooled by the title. This surprise seventh studio album, his first in 4 years, is Justin's most expansive and ambitious work to date. Standout tracks from his ruminations on fame, marriage, and fatherhood include Yukon, Butterflies, Way It Is, Sweet Spot, and Devotion. The one and only Vivian Stone. In Melissa O'Connor's debut novel, Margot discovers unlabeled cassette tapes in her late grandmother's home. After she recruits her first love and epic heartbreak to fix the tape player, she is shocked to hear comedy legend Vivian Stone chronicling a scandalous story with mysterious ties to Margot. Iron by Post Animal. The psychedelic rock band reunites its original lineup, including Stranger Things' Joe Keery, and allows all their eclectic influences to bubble forth on their fourth full-length album. Blending dreamy riffs, introspective lyrics, and a sprinkle of Muppet sounds, it's a truly solid record. That's our must list this week. Fantastic Four First Steps, Justin Bieber's Swag, and Light and Magic top this week's list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. Well, since they mentioned Fantastic Four, they also have a review. Pedro Pascal leads the team back to the retro future in colorful new version. Pedro Pascal, Vanessa Kirby, Joseph Quinn, and Ivan Mas-Bachrach give new, old-fashioned life to the Fantastic Four. This is by Marine Lee Lanker. They say the third time's the charm, and when it comes to the Fantastic Four, that just might be true. The Marvel comic book characters comprised of Reed Richards, who's also Mr. Fantastic, played by Pedro Pascal, Sue Storm, who's the Invisible Woman, played by Vanessa Kirby, Johnny Storm, playing the Human Torch, by Joseph Quinn, and Ben Grimm, who's the Thing, played by Ebon Moss-Bacharach, have struggled to find their footing in the cinematic superhero pantheon. But the Fantastic Four First Steps Out Friday is the most promising step in the right direction yet. Working from a script by Josh Friedman, Eric Pearson, Jeff Kaplan, and Ian Springer, if the screenplay feels a bit cobbled together, which it does, it's almost certainly because of the number of cooks in the proverbial kitchen. Director Matt Shakman from WandaVision sets this version of the Fantastic Four in a retro-futuristic world that feels like the Jetsons and Mad Men had a love child. Via this 1960s-coded setting, Shakman leans into the comic book kitschiness inherent to the material, embracing it with gonzo gusto as opposed to trying to achieve any degree of gritty realism. Honestly, historical settings, or alternate versions of them, are a woefully undertapped region of superhero storytelling, allowing the characters to exist in a world that thrives on tropes and genre signposts without needing to foreground the realism of a contemporary scenario. Its setting is Fantastic Four's secret weapon, making the otherwise ridiculous stretching abilities of Reed Richards, the radioactive gentle giant that is the Thing, the den mother vibes of Sue Storm, and the cocky womanizing wiles of Johnny Storm into something quaint and retro cool. The film is at its best when it's leaning into its space race sense of wonder, mid-century modern trappings, and the charming novelty of its retro-futuristic technology. From its Saul Bass-inspired opening credits to its callbacks to Saturday morning superhero cartoons, it practically vibrates with its sense of time and place. Production designer Kasra Farahani and costume designer Alexandra Brine enhance Shakman's vision, painting this world in Betty Crocker reds and whites, modish burnt oranges, and buoyant blues. They build a world that is old-fashioned and familiar, whimsical even, while infusing everything with a streak of technological advancement and innovation. In this version of the quartet story, set on Earth 828, the Four have been heroes for 4 years, having acquired their cosmic superpowers during an accident on a mission to space, this multiverse's version of the Apollo Project. Sue and Reed are long married, secure in their retrospective roles as a diplomat and a popular scientist. They live with Sue's brother, Johnny, who seems unfazed by his ability to turn into a campfire in the blink of an eye, and Reed's best friend, Ben Grimm, who has been transformed into the craggy Thing. Under the watchful eye of their robot butler, Herbie, voiced by Matthew Wood, they're a family. But when Sue and Reed discover they're expecting a longed-for baby, it casts their bonds and their responsibilities to the people of the world in a new light. That is further complicated by the arrival of extraterrestrial Harold, the Silver Surfer, played by Julia Garner, who proclaims the coming of Galactus, that's Ralph Ineson, devourer of planets. Despite Sue's advanced pregnancy and her chic maternity uniform, the quartet resolves to return to space to defeat Galactus before he ever reaches Earth. But this big bad is the Rumpelstiltskin of supervillains, demanding the one thing Reed and Sue cannot bear to give: their child. From there, we're plunged into a parable of what it means to be a savior, and the weight of the expectation to sacrifice the happiness of a few for the lives of the many. It's a murky ethical dilemma, one that pits the sanctity of the family unit against the survival of the world. Yet, the film also recognizes that to give up one is to lose the other. As Sue Storm tells their detractors, family is about connecting to someone bigger than ourselves. In a time when so many of us feel desperate for community and connection, this is a compelling narrative focus, particularly because this cosmic crew doesn't look at all like the traditional nuclear family of the 1960s, no matter how many crisp white shirts Pascal wears. However, this points to the film's central, if unintentional, tension between its reinforcement of traditional values and its progressive push for a kinder, unified world. This narrative dissonance is amplified by the film's continuation of Marvel's female problems, using its two main female characters as sacrificial lambs. It's an endlessly exhausting trope that Marvel can't seem to stop perpetuating. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has long excelled in its casting, and the Fantastic Four First Steps is no exception. Pascal at last gets a superb filmic vehicle for his charms, one that allows him to exude both his classic movie star swagger and his more modern sensitivity, which simmers beneath the surface every moment he's on screen. Kirby lends Sue an ethereal sensibility, which speaks to the paradox of her heroism and her maternal role in the storytelling. She gives new meaning to the notion that a mother could lift a car to save her child. Quinn brings Steve McQueen cool to Johnny Storm, making him more the epitome of mid-century aloof masculinity than a cocky man-child, while Moss Bacharach imbues Ben Grimm with the greatest humanity of the four, despite his igneous exterior. All four performers capture something quintessential to the 1960s vibe, a sense that they are a piece of this world and products of their time. Too often, casting directors opt for actors who have resting cell phone face, but Sarah Finn, who has assembled every member of the Avengers, has a knack for getting this crucial detail right. From Peggy Carter to Sue Storm, Finn has consistently found old souls to embody new stories. The Fantastic Four First Steps is perhaps Marvel's biggest swing since Thor in terms of its willingness to embrace the more ludicrous and wacky elements of its comic book origins. Is moving from teleporting an egg to teleporting an entire planet preposterous? Yes. But it's also utterly true to the logic of comic book lore. The Fantastic Four wholeheartedly waves its freak flag with characters like the Mole Man, played by Paul Walter Hauser, and his realm of Subterranea. The visual effects department nails the powers of the quartet, rendering Mr. Fantastic's elasticity and Johnny Storm's ability to flame on in ways that are both believable and fun, eschewing some of the hokier pitfalls of earlier adaptations. Though the entire film goes for broke, some scenes are more successful than others, with Kirby in particular asked to swing for the fences. If you thought her birth scene in Pieces of a Woman was harrowing, Fantastic Four gives it a run for its money in a far more ridiculous context as Sue Storm must bellow through labor pains while the four hurtle through space and try to evade the Silver Surfer. Kirby commits like a champ, but the scene is inherently absurd, as Reed tries to talk her through a berth in zero gravity. It's more silly than serious, but damn if Pascal and Kirby don't sell it for all it's worth. Michael Giacchino's whimsical score is the cherry on top of this comic book sundae. It's a bit of a full circle moment as Giacchino gained early recognition for composing the score for Pixar's The Incredibles, a film that drew pointedly from the superpowers and the 60s trappings of the original Fantastic Four comics. That twinkling 1960s sound gets repurposed here and given enough oomph with more solemn, sweeping melodies. Indeed, this iteration of the Fantastic Four shares more with The Incredibles than it does with Avengers Endgame or Thunderbolts, feeling almost like a live-action adaptation of Pixar's animated homage to superheroes. Much like the other biggest superhero movie of the summer, Superman, the Fantastic Four First Steps isn't interested in apologizing for or trying to hide its source material. Instead, it throws the audience into its pop candy world, exploding with color, goofy adversaries, and throwback costumes. Because it knows that comic book stories are akin to myth in our world, a cinematic answer to Greek oral storytelling traditions. These movies are money-making blockbusters, but they are also a prism through which we collectively navigate morality, heroism, and our values. And sometimes the only way to do that is to get a little ridiculous, even if the end result isn't entirely fantastic. That is the review of the Fantastic Four First Steps. Pedro Pascal leads the team back to the retro future in colorful new version. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, who's giving the movie a grade of B. The other review we have this week is about King of the Hill. Hank Hill is the man America needs right now. The long-running animated comedy from Mike Judge and Greg Daniels returns for a hilarious new season on Hulu. This is by Kristen Baldwin. In one of King of the Hill's final episodes before the comedy's 15-year hiatus, a Canadian family moved in next door to Texas residents Hank, played by Mike Judge, and Peggy Hill, played by Kathy Najimy, for the summer. As staunch patriots, Hank and his buddies, that's Dale Gribble, voiced by Johnny Hardwick, Boomhauer, played by Judge, and Bill Dottery, played by Stephen Root, weren't pleased about the development, but Hank insisted that they treat the foreign visitors with respect. "We're Americans," he told them. "We're the world's welcome mat. It doesn't matter if they're from Canada, Laos, or, God forbid, California. Right now, they're from Rainy Street, and it's our patriotic duty to show them what good neighbors are all about." A lot has changed in the 15 years since Fox canceled King of the Hill, both for the characters in the fictional town of Arlen, Texas, and for the America that Hank Hill holds so dear. The once foundational concept of patriotism is now a source of vitriolic debate, and the idea that the U.S. should be the world's welcome mat is anathema to many of those who identify as conservative in 2025. King of the Hill's long-awaited, fantastically funny 14th season allows Hank to confront our new reality without sacrificing his steadfast dedication to truth, civility, and propane. Sharp and heartfelt as ever, the Emmy-winning animated comedy from Mike Judge and Greg Daniels is back right when America needs it most. After spending the last several years in Saudi Arabia, where Hank worked as an assistant manager, propane and propane accessories division, for Aramco, the Hills return to a Texas they barely recognize. "Are we still in Amsterdam?" Hank wonders as he and Peggy walk past all the luxury retail shops in the Dallas airport. All gender bathrooms, electric vehicles, boba tea restaurants, no left turns to reduce carbon emissions. It's all new to the Hills, and Hank, for one, isn't sure he likes it. "What happened to this town?" he groans, driving by a sign for goat therapy and a billboard offering legal services for victims of microaggression. Elise's alley pals have retained their signature eccentricities. Affable and unintelligible ladies' man, Boomhauer, is now a father figure to his girlfriend's anxious son, Luke Jr. Conspiracy theory enthusiast, Dale, dabbled in politics before declaring himself an election denier. And lonely, loyal Bill coped with Hank and Peggy's absence by becoming one with his bed and binge-watching Netflix. Joining the group for beers on occasion is Brian Robertson, played by Keith David, who rented the Hills home while they were away and really thinks they should consider solar panels. The Hills' adorably earnest son, Bobby, played by Pamela Adlon, is now 21 years old and the head chef at Robata Chain, a traditional Japanese barbecue with a fusion of flavors and techniques from the German traditions of the Texas Hill Country. As always, King of the Hill mines its comedy from day-to-day life in Arlen. Peggy and Hank are now retired, and many of the new season's storylines stem from the couple's search for ways to occupy themselves. Hank and Bobby brew their own beer. Peggy needs an MRI for a pickleball injury, but the machine gives her panic attacks. Boomer tries to maintain his perfect rating on a TaskRabbit-style app called ChoreChimp. Bobby reconnects with childhood crush Connie Supanusaphone, that's played by Lauren Tom, though he must compete for her affections with Chain, played by Ki Hong Lee, the obnoxious son of Robata Chain investor Ted Wassenaar, played by Kenneth Choi. When King of the Hill doesn't take on more fraught issues of the day, cultural appropriation, the manosphere, misinformation, surveillance culture, online shaming, it does so with its signature blend of insight, sly humor, and silliness. Obama was born in Hawaii. That's reason enough not to vote for him without making stuff up, huffs Hank, arguing with a birther he encounters at the George W. Bush Presidential Library. The writing is evocative and intelligent, and season 14 delivers more laughs per episode than most current comedies. The wordplay, like a karaoke bar called A Lone Star Is Born, is beyond reproach. Longtime fans are rewarded with delightful Easter eggs, two words, shin jelly, callbacks to classic episodes, and the continuation of running gags. Yes, Dale's wife, Nancy, voiced by Ashley Gardner, and John Redcorn, voiced by the late Jonathan Joss, are still very close. Even at its lowest, when changing social mores and fractious public discourse leave him frustrated and dismayed, Hank Hill maintains an unwavering belief in the promise of our nation. "It's gonna be okay," he tells Peggy. "America is still the best goddang country on earth. I tell you what, King of the Hill just might be the most inspirational show of the year." All 10 episodes of King of the Hill premiere Monday, August 4th on Hulu. That's the King of the Hill review. Hank Hill is the man America needs right now. It was by Kristen Baldwin, who is giving this season a grade of A-. I'm a tad early here because this next article is a little long. I'm breaking in to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly magazine, and I'm reading from their website, which is EW.com. Also out, it's not a review, but here we break down Happy Gilmore 2's biggest cameos and Easter eggs. There's a spoiler alert marking on this, but I've read the article, and it's really just talking about who is in the movie, and it's not really giving anything away, and this is a Happy Gilmore movie, so not really any surprises are ruined. This is by Lauren Huff. And here are the key points. We break down all of the biggest cameos in Happy Gilmore 2, from Eminem to Travis Kelce to Bad Bunny. Plus, Entertainment Weekly explains all of the fun callbacks and Easter eggs to the first film and star Adam Sandler's career, and even his in-real-life family. All of the guest stars left an impression on Sandler, who says every single person brought their full tilt A-game to set. After almost 30 years, Happy Gilmore is back on the fairway. This time around, a now-retired Happy, played by Adam Sandler, who has fallen on some really tough times, returns to golf to pay for his daughter Vienna's ballet school. In the process, he might just save the future of the sport. In addition to Sandler, returning stars from the original 1996 film include Julie Bowen as Virginia Vennett and Christopher McDonald as Shooter McGavin. Along the way, Happy encounters an array of famous faces, including sports stars, pro golfers, major Hollywood players, and even Sandler's real-life family. When someone's doing a cameo, they're coming by, giving their time, and you want them to have a fun time and make it worth their while, Sandler tells Entertainment Weekly. Nobody didn't bring the full tilt A-game. We wrote stuff, they came up with stuff. There's a million athletes in the movie from every sport. Every golfer I love is in it. Of course, Travis Kelce is incredibly talented. Bad Bunny never stops being funny. He continues, no matter what, no matter who was in the movie, it was an exciting day. It was just whatever scene we were shooting, we were like, holy cow, we're going to be hanging out with John Daly today. Holy cow! There's just so many people that made it exciting. Happy Gilmore 2, which is now playing on Netflix, is also chock full of Easter eggs to the first film and Sandler's lengthy comedy career as a whole. In case you missed any of it, Entertainment Weekly is breaking down all of the film's biggest cameos and connections. A family affair. What could be better than one Sandler in a film? All the Sandlers, of course. Happy Gilmore 2 delivers on that front. The comedian's wife, Jackie, and two daughters, Sunny and Sadie, all appear in the film. Sunny plays Happy's beloved only daughter, Vienna, and Jackie plays her dance instructor, who encourages her to attend the Paris dance program. Sadie, meanwhile, plays a fellow member of Happy's Alkies for Life program, who is later revealed to be an FBI plant. At the end of the film, the two share a tongue-in-cheek moment when Sadie's character tells Happy, "You remind me of my dad." But the fun doesn't end there. Sandler's brother-in-law, Christopher Titone, plays a repo man. His mother-in-law, Lila Titone, plays Lila. His cousin, Jana Sandler, plays one of the Jeopardy contestants. And Sandler's mother, Judy, plays Drago Larson's mother. Happy's time on SNL. At the beginning of the film, we see a few short clips of Happy going on Saturday Night Live at the height of his golf game. In real life, of course, Sandler was a cast member on the NBC sketch comedy series from 1990 to 1995. He also received an Emmy nomination when he returned as host in 2019. Ben Stiller. In the first film, Stiller played the villainous Hal L., a retirement home orderly who terrorizes Happy's grandma and the other elderly residents. In Happy Gilmore 2, he reprises that role, but this time around, Hal has left the nursing home and now runs a support group called Alkies for Life. He's still a grifter, though, and thanks to the character played by Sadie, finally gets his just desserts at the end of the film. Honoring the Dead. Happy Gilmore 2 is not subtle in its attempts to honor the stars of the first film who have sadly passed away. In one particularly on-the-nose scene, Shooter and Happy battle it out, literally over the graves of Bob Barker, who died in 2023, Chubbs, played by Carl Weathers, who died in 2024, Grandma, played by Frances Bay, who died in 2011, and more. New faces. Although most of the famous faces on this list have some connection to the first film, there are still a staggering number of new people to mention. Principal new players include filmmaker and actor Benny Safdie as Maxi Golf creator and the film's main antagonist, Frank Manatee. And Bad Bunny is Happy's new caddy. Haley Joel Osment plays a rival golfer. Margaret Qualley, Eric Andre, and SNL's Martin Herlihy, son of Tim, who co-wrote the film with Sandler, play amateur golfers who are forced to play with a newly unretired Happy at the beginning of the film. Kelce pops up as a mean-spirited waiter who fires Bad Bunny's character and later appears in his Happy Place, Dreams, shirtless, tied to a post, covered in honey, and finally attacked by a bear. Similarly hilarious is Steve Buscemi as Happy's wild neighbor. Scott Miscudi, a.k.a. Kid Cootie, appears at the end as one of the FBI agents who takes down Stiller's Hal. Sportscasters Stephen A. Smith, Dan Patrick, and Vern Lundquist, who also popped up in Happy Gilmore, Jeopardy host Ken Jennings, and celebrity chef Guy Fieri play heightened or fictionalized versions of themselves. Professional wrestler and actor Maxwell Jacob Friedman, Philip Schneider, Ethan Kutkowski, Connor Sherry, Kim Whitley, John Farley, Austin Post, a.k.a. Post Malone, Marcelo Hernandez, Oliver Hudson, Reggie Bush, Nikki Garcia, Becky Lynch, co-writer Tim Herlihy, rapper Cameron, John Lovitz, and Kevin Nealon, who played Potter in the first film, also round out the cast. Another gentle giant. Who could forget Mr. Larson, Happy's intimidating but friendly former boss, played by Richard Kiel? Standing at over 7 feet tall, Kiel, who played Jaws in the Bond films, is hard to forget. Sadly, he died in 2014, but he's perfectly honored in Happy Gilmore 2 by former NBA player Boban Marjanovic, who plays Larson's son, Drago, who is even taller at a whopping 7'4". Eminem. In the first film, Joe Flaherty's character famously heckles Happy by repeatedly calling him a jackass right before he's set to putt. Flaherty died in 2024, but Eminem, donning a beard and a sun hat, picks up the mantle in Happy Gilmore 2, calling him, you guessed it, a jackass. Unfortunately for him, the alligators are back in this film too, and Happy gets the last laugh when the beasts kill Eminem's heckler on the course. Meet Slim. Chubbs famously dies in the first film, but he still plays a large part in the second. We see his grave, and he's mentioned several times, but his son, Slim, played by Lavelle Crawford, also features in the movie. Like his father, he has a wooden hand. He lost his in a vending machine accident, not to an alligator, and serves in a supportive role to Happy on his journey to be a successful golfer again. The return of nipple-pinching Waterboy Coach. Cue more nipple-pinching memes of actor Blake Clark, who played the pierced farmer Fran in 1998's Waterboy, and appears in a similar state in Happy Gilmore 2. Clark is a regular in Adam's flicks, also appearing in 50 First Dates, Grown Ups, I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, and Mr. Deeds. Unforgettable cameos. What would a Happy Gilmore movie be without a bevy of professional golfers to bring it all to life? Like the first film, Happy Gilmore 2 features several real-life golfers, including John Daly, Keegan Bradley, Bryson DeChambeau, Tony Finau, Ricky Fowler, Brooks Koepka, Rory McIlroy, Colin Morikawa, Jack Nicklaus, Xander Schauffele, Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Bubba Watson, Will Zalatoris, Nelly Korda, Nancy Lopez, and Paige Spiranak. Caddyshack. Speaking of the golf pros, Zalatoris has sort of a dual role. He's technically playing himself, but he's also revealed to be the grown-up version of Happy's poor, oft-abused cabbie in the first film. Apparently, he changed his name. In the original, that role was played by Jared Van Snellenberg, who retired from acting in 2003 and went on to become a neuroscientist and a professor. You can do it! Towards the end of the film, Rob Schneider, pedaling away on his bike, tells Happy, "You can do it!" This is a running gag between Adam and Schneider. Schneider has uttered the line in many of Adam's films, starting with The Waterboy. The bit has continued through Little Nicky, 50 First Dates, The Longest Yard, and Bedtime Stories, as well as in a deleted scene from Click. A very happy ending. At the end of Happy Gilmore, Happy sees a ghostly version of Abraham Lincoln, Chubbs, and the alligator who took his hand, waving to him from heaven. In the sequel, he sees the same thing, but Grandma, Mr. Larson, Bob Barker, the jackass hecklers from both films, and his late wife, Virginia, are also shown. Virginia even sweetly tells him, "Oh, you're okay." That is breaking down Happy Gilmore 2's biggest cameos and Easter eggs, and it was by Lauren Huff. Saturday Night Live was mentioned in that last article, and here's a connection to that, and this is exclusive only to Entertainment Weekly. Dan Aykroyd explains why he skipped SNL 50, the special, and reveals the moment that made him emotional watching at home. Dan Aykroyd is still a devoted viewer of Saturday Night Live to this day. This is by Maureen Lee Lenker. After all these years, Dan Aykroyd still isn't ready for primetime, but in this case, it was his choice. Earlier this year, Aykroyd, who broke out as an original member of the Saturday Night Live cast in the 1970s, was noticeably absent from the SNL 50 anniversary special. But he's still close to his Studio 8H roots and is even releasing a forthcoming graphic novel that continues the story of the Blues Brothers, one of his most iconic SNL characters. As it turns out, Aykroyd loves the NBC sketch show so much that he actively chose to sit out the 50th so he could watch the special without interruption from home. "I wanted to be at home, and I wanted to watch the show beginning to end," Aykroyd reveals to Entertainment Weekly while stopping by our video studio at Comic-Con 2025. "I knew if I was there, I'd be in a dressing room, I'd be working," he continues. "I wanted to see it live. I'm a fan of the show today, and I watch it all the time. I love these new players. I think they're just great. I just wanted to see and live nostalgically with my family in my own home, eating my own popcorn." Several of Aykroyd's fellow original cast members were present, however, including Lorraine Newman and Jane Curtin. Newman even did a sketch with more recent alum Pete Davidson, in which she reminisced about her time on the show, while Davidson reprised his recurring character of Chad, responding, "Okay," to Newman's heartfelt stories. Newman and Curtin were also responsible for one of the night's most moving moments, including holding up a photograph of the late Gilda Radner during the cast's goodbyes at the end of the show. "Lorraine's piece, definitely," Aykroyd responds when asked about what segment of the show made him the most emotional. "That was beautiful. That was wonderful." Aykroyd also reminisces about his time making the Blues Brothers alongside blues legends that he grew up admiring. He remembers his time filming with Aretha Franklin in the diner in particular, noting that he was incredibly nervous to be sharing the screen with her. "As soon as she started to sing, I got a feeling in my stomach," he shares. "When I stood up off the stool, I thought my legs were going to buckle." Jake and Elwood are still in jail in 1997, and now they're trophies, and no one wants to let them go, Aykroyd teases of the book, which hits shelves on October 7th, and the story picks up from there. Aykroyd also weighed in on Dylan O'Brien's portrayal of him in last year's Saturday Night. We can watch his full interview in the live stream that's linked in the article. That was Dan Aykroyd explains why he skipped SNL 50 special and reveals the moment that made him emotional watching at home. That was by Maureen Lee Lenker. Do you remember Galaxy Quest? Here's an article. Sam Rockwell tried to induce nervous breakdown for scenes in Galaxy Quest. People were like, "What are you doing?" The actor referenced Gene Wilder's performance in The Producers as a perfect example of what he was trying to do. This is by Rachel Shufelt. When Sam Rockwell gets a role, he's all in, dancing or whatever needs to be done. But when asked about the most ridiculous role he's ever committed to, there's a clear winner. Guy Fliegman, whom he played in Galaxy Quest, the 1999 movie about the cast of a former sci-fi TV series having to assume their roles in real life in order to save the universe. Well, I think Galaxy Quest comes to mind as far as taking it very seriously, Rockwell said of the sci-fi parody on Thursday's episode of Hot Ones. I was walking around, having a lot of coffee, getting really hyped up and trying to have a nervous breakdown on camera so that people would laugh at it, which is totally ridiculous. People were like, "What are you doing, man? It's a comedy." But you know, you have to really break down or it's not funny. He pointed to Gene Wilder's performance as Leo Bloom in Mel Brooks' iconic 1967 movie, The Producers, as proof. Wilder, who died in 2016, is a perfect example of that, Rockwell said. He has a real anxiety attack and it's hilarious. Wilder was nominated for an Oscar in the category of Best Supporting Actor for his work in the iconic film, although it's unclear how much of it was acting and how much of it was at least inspired by real life. The veteran of movies such as Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and Young Frankenstein told Time in 1970 that he'd always had a reservoir of hysteria, although he'd grown out of it. As for Rockwell, he's previously described his transformation for the spoof that he co-starred in with Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, and the late Alan Rickman in a similar way. "You have to play that for real," he told HuffPost in 2013. "I'm really crying in the spaceship when I'm freaking out." He also said then that he'd done full emotional preparation. "I had 4 cups of coffee, and I was doing it as if it was a drama for me," Rockwell explained. "Knowing that the outcome is going to be a funny outcome, that people will be laughing at my tragedy. I was pacing, and I think Bill Paxton did the same thing in Aliens, knowing he's the funny guy, but he's got to be freaked out. He has to be legitimately scared, and that's what makes it funny. That's what great farce is, raising the stakes." We can watch Rockwell's full Hot Ones conversation in the link that's in the article. That was Sam Rockwell tried to induce nervous breakdown for scenes in Galaxy Quest. People were like, "What are you doing?" That was by Rachel Schofield. This one was sort of sad for me. Resident Alien canceled at USA after 4 seasons. The final episode of Season 4, which will act as the series finale, airs August 8th. This is by Decia Tolentino. Resident Alien, a cult favorite sci-fi dramedy on the USA Network, has been canceled after 4 seasons, Entertainment Weekly has confirmed. The show had faced an uncertain future after narrowly escaping cancellation last season. Season 4 was written as though it would be the final season, and the finale will be satisfying for fans, Entertainment Weekly has learned. The season finale, which will now serve as the series finale, will air on August 8th. Creator Chris Sheridan told TV Insider that he knew this would likely be the final season, explaining that it was exciting to shape the rest of the show with this in mind. "I knew we could spend the time wrapping up some storylines and driving toward an ending," Sheridan told TV Insider. "I'm so proud of how good season 4 is, and especially proud that we were able to finish as strongly as we did, with the finale that is probably my favorite episode of the series." Resident Alien follows an alien, played by Alan Tudyk, who was sent to Earth to destroy humanity. He crash lands in a Colorado town and assumes the identity of Dr. Harry Vanderspiegel, a doctor he killed. After being pushed into the position of town doctor, Harry develops empathy for humanity and abandons his mission to protect humans from extraterrestrial threats. Originally a sci-fi series, Resident Alien moved to USA after season 3, although it simulcasts on both channels. This series is the latest current scripted series on USA. Its upcoming legal drama, The Rainmaker, premieres on August 15th. USA and Sci-Fi are moving under Versant, a cable spin-off company from NBC Universal. While the current scripted lineup for USA is slim, Versant recently announced the first slate of shows, including a new drama titled Anna Pigeon, which is expected to hit the network in 2026. That was Resident Alien canceled at USA after four seasons, and it was by Decia Tolentino. And there's a related article here about how the Resident Alien cast, how they're responding to the cancellation at Comic-Con. Fans will be really satisfied. This is by Ryan Coleman. Resident Alien may be coming to an end, but star Sarah Tomko has a promise for fans. You won't be disappointed by what's to come. Tomko joined her co-stars Alan Tudyk, Corey Reynolds, and Alice Wetterland, as well as creator Chris Sheridan, at the Entertainment Weekly studio at San Diego Comic-Con 2025 to discuss the quirky sci-fi comedy's fourth season, which was revealed Friday to be its last. Entertainment Weekly editor-in-chief Patrick Gomez starts the conversation by asking the assembled residents about the bad news, which causes Tudyk to double over in pain and let out a long groan. Wetterland pats her co-star's back while Tomko sympathetically coos, "Aw, baby." The actress jokes he had just forgotten, then remembered all over again. Resident Alien is currently airing its fourth season, so Sheridan cautions that it's hard to say much without spoiling what's coming. Wetterland adds that there's a lot of wrong turns you can take in describing what happens, but snarks, "I think disappointing people has been one of the greatest things, making people sad. We made you laugh for a long time." Based on the comic series by Peter Hogan and Steve Parkhouse, Resident Alien unfolds with the humorous verve of the moral dilemma of Harry Vanderspiegel, an alien, played by Tudyk, who takes over the body of a small-town doctor and subsequently begins to question his mission to destroy Earth. Tomko, who plays Nurse Asta Twelvetrees, one of the first residents of the fictional Patients Colorado to discover Harry's true identity, says that Sheridan recently described the Resident Alien's cancellation in a way that perfectly sums up the cast and crew's feelings. "We've set up a world where things happen in Patients, and this is a story arc that started from the pilot in season one and is now going to finish in season four. So I think our fans will be satisfied from point A to B to C to D to the finish line," she paraphrases. I think we hoped there was a possibility we could go on, but it's just nice to feel like we've offered a solution to ourselves as writers, as a cast, to be able to just say, this is where this particular story arc ends. I think fans will be really, really satisfied with that, as we are. Sheridan told TV Insider on Thursday that he had a feeling season four might be the show's last. "I knew we could spend the time wrapping up some storylines and driving toward an ending. I'm so proud of how good season four is, and especially proud that we were able to finish as strongly as we did, with a finale that is probably my favorite episode of the series," he said. With only three episodes to go, fans will soon be able to evaluate Resident Alien in totality for themselves. The series airs one of its last episodes on Friday with the appropriately titled finale, The End Is Here, coming on August 8th. We can watch the entire Comic-Con live stream that's linked in the article. That is Resident Alien cast response to show cancellation at Comic-Con. Fans will be really satisfied. And it was by Ryan Coleman. As we're starting to wind down now, I have Wednesday star Steve Buscemi recalls his worst auditions with directors Barry Levinson and Mike Nichols. They went wrong for two very different reasons. This is by Rachel Shufelt. Steve Buscemi's had a lot of acting jobs in such movies as Fargo and Ghost World, and on TV series like Boardwalk Empire and The Sopranos. But he claims that he's not any good at auditions, really. I was always hot and cold, he said Wednesday on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. I never knew if I should wing it, because sometimes I'd be good if I went in the room and I didn't really prepare, and then the next time I'd do it, I would fail. He recalled two unfortunate experiences with two Oscar-winning directors, Barry Levinson, who helmed Bugsy, Diner, and Rain Man, and the late Mike Nichols, the man behind Working Girl, Silkwood, and The Graduate. Both had released acclaimed films before Buscemi earned his first professional acting credits in the 80s. Buscemi decided that he had to take a different approach when he went in for a role in Levinson's 1987 movie Tin Men, which starred Richard Dreyfuss and Danny DeVito. He didn't say which part he auditioned. I studied the sides, the script, and went in there and did my reading, Buscemi said. And he looked at me and he went, "That was really good. That's really good, Steve. All right, let's do it again." Levinson then gave Buscemi a note about tone, he said. He asked Buscemi to do it again, and he did exactly that. There was this silence, and we both just looked at each other. I think I even said, "That was the same, wasn't it?" Buscemi remembers, and he said, "Yeah, it's okay, it's okay." Needless to say, I didn't get that part. The audition for Nichols, who died in 2014, didn't go well either, but for a much different reason. Buscemi described the project as a Nichols film written by Neil Simon and acclaimed casting director Juliet Taylor, which would fit the description of the 1988 movie Biloxi Blues, starring Matthew Broderick and Christopher Walken. I didn't want to go on the audition because I knew I had something else booked and that I wasn't available, he explained. My agent at the time said, no, just go. When are you going to have an opportunity to meet these people? So he went, and he killed it. They love it. They were laughing. They were like, "That's great," said Buscemi, who then asked about the shooting dates and revealed that he wasn't available. I told them in the room, and again, this silence, Buscemi said, and I could see Juliet Taylor looking at me going, "What is wrong with you?" It worked out okay for the actor who currently stars on the Netflix series Wednesday, which returns August 6th. That was Wednesday star Steve Buscemi recalls his worst auditions with directors Barry Levinson and Mike Nichols. And it was by Rachel Schofield. And I had this as a sidebar to King of the Hill, but wasn't sure that I had enough time. But we do. King of the Hill showrunner discusses diversifying reboot cast. The world has changed. Reboot showrunner Saladin K. Patterson discusses the new cast with original series creators Mike Judge and Greg Daniels at San Diego Comic-Con 2025. It's by Ryan Coleman. The creative minds behind the King of the Hill reboot are excited to introduce fans to some new people that have joined the family. The whip-smart animated sitcom chronicling the suburban exploits of the Hill family and their friends and neighbors in the fictional small town of Arlen, Texas, is returning after 15 long years off the air. During a Friday panel at San Diego Comic-Con 2025, showrunner Saladin K. Patterson, original series creators Mike Judge and Greg Daniels, and returning stars Pamela Adlon, Lauren Tom, Toby Huss, and Kathy Najimy discussed their return to Arlen, including some of its brand new residents. It was important in the show. The world has changed a little bit since Hank and Peggy have been gone, Patterson said. Casting has changed a little bit, too, since Hank and Peggy have been gone, as far as actors fit the characters that they're portraying. The King of the Hill panel began with a screening of the full second episode of the new season. While some things about the Hills, the Alley Gang, the residents of Rainy Street, and the world around them are comfortingly familiar, there are plenty of fresh new additions, and tweaks, too. King of the Hill Season 14 not only introduces new characters, but recasts the voices behind several characters of color. The most exciting new addition to the King of the Hill cast is the legendary Keith David, who plays a character named Brian Robertson. Brian moved into the Hill House while Hank, played by Judge, and Peggy, played by Najimi, decamped for Saudi Arabia on an Aramco project during the show's hiatus. The Hills have not only moved back to Arlen, but into their old house, and Brian's happy to join Hank, Dale, Boomhauer, and Bill during the Alley Gang's Alley Hangs. Though it was always savvily written along cultural lines and already boasted a cast of characters from a diverse array of backgrounds, King of the Hill was criticized during its original run for casting several white actors to voice characters of color. The reboot recast several of these characters, with Kenneth Choi taking over for Huss as the voice of Laotian American businessman Ted Wasansong, Ki Hong Lee replacing Adlon as his boastful son Chain, Ronnie Ching relieving Huss of the role as the Hill's Laotian American next-door neighbor, and Native American actor Ty LeClaire taking over the role of Bobby's friend Joseph Gribble from Brecken Meyer, who himself took over for Brittany Murphy in 2000. Patterson enthused that the reboot's creative team got very lucky in being able to have so many people who were big fans of the show, like Ronnie Ching, who grew up watching the show. He was a fan of it and came and joined us. That was King of the Hill showrunner discusses diversifying reboot cast, The World Has Changed, and it was by Ryan Coleman. And that really rounds us out for our time this week. Thank you all for listening. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury, and I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Please come back next week, and we'll do this again. Until then, goodbye.